Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jessamine Ward. Little Beast by C. Pam Zhang. At 13, I felt my body slopping. Though I sat in the middle of the nurse's height-weight chart, though I'd memorized the textbook diagram with its cake-like cross-section of flesh, epidermis, dermis, hypodermis, stippled yellow with fat, my problem went deeper than biology. Mine was a more fundamental failure. My posture was liquid and my spine non-existent, despite containing the requisite 33 vertebrae. I spilled into conversations and overshared the banal. My words manifested as spit on listeners' cheeks. Even teachers wore expressions of disgust when my hand shot up, expressions blotted away by sympathy like a napkin blots grease. Of course, no one at Alta said a thing. Alta was an all-girls school built on progressive principles. Marble halls, uniforms androgynous and ethically sourced. Conceived by third-wave feminists, Alta wasn't named after some saint. It stood for the Academy for the Literacy and Tutelage of Aspirants. Aspirants were bright young women who would one day found a nonprofit or direct quiet, critically reviewed films that didn't sell, a fact that wouldn't matter because Alta believed in riches above money, a slogan displayed without irony atop the annual list of donors. Aspirants included senators' daughters, screenwriters' daughters, celebrities' daughters, the ethically exotic daughters of parents so undiscussed it was clear they were heir to secret dynasties. And me, janitor's daughter, scholarship kid. My father said, "Quit your fretting, girlie." My father said, "They'll like you if you act yourself." When this proved futile, my father said, "You'll only grow into yourself." But what did he know? My father bought our jeans from Walmart bargain bins, our dinners from grocery outlet. He laughed too loud. In public, he was fond of asking what had clogged our toilet, what size training bra I wore. In the dusk hours between the end of my day and the beginning of his, as our lean cuisines orbited in the microwave's glow, my father asked endless questions about my wins in the biology Olympiad, about my homeroom teacher, about the girls he insisted on calling my friends. I mumbled, which made him bend closer. In his soft spine, in his supplicant's pose, I saw and despised myself. My father had it wrong. I didn't care about the girls who asked me so kindly, "How are you? Did you change your hair? Doing anything fun this weekend?" Girls who smiled at my answers and then drifted back to discussing tennis coaches and ski trips, the afterglow of their charity making them even more resplendent. And I didn't care about the frizzy, sharp-voiced girls who sat with me at the Olympiad and debated their horses with glee. I didn't care about the girls who volunteered for senators on weekends and cornered me with petitions, describing themselves as future leaders. Oh, there were aspirants of every kind at Alta, girls so golden you had to sort them into further shades of bronze and lemon and amber, gorgeous girls and kind girls and smart girls and nervy girls and charming girls, and most of all, wealthy girls. At another school, I might have dreamed of befriending any one of them, but because my father was Alta's night janitor, he knew their secrets by way of secretaries and cafeteria ladies, by way of lockers and trash cans. He told me whose birthday was coming up, who passed notes to whom, and who loved hot Cheetos or chess. His disclosures scrubbed those aspirants as clean of interest as the floors he mopped at night. Alta's motto was self-expression, open dialogue, open heart, and my father warped those words to excess, an excess I'd inherited. His DNA ran riot through my cells, spattered from my voice, his shamefulness breaking out like acne over me. The girls I yearned to know were the ones wrapped in silence. Even teachers didn't bother calling on them. Not glowing, but shadowed girls, skinny wraiths with bitten nails, dark circles, dry hair, an exhaustion that made them seem older and wiser. Such girls had no hobbies or sports teams that I knew of, though participation was mandatory at Alta. It was as if whatever drained them was extracurricular enough. A bit strange was the strongest thing I heard said about the silent girls, thanks to Alta's rampant kindness. Mostly those girls were buffered in silence as they passed through the halls. There were maybe five of them, though the precise number was slippery. They disappeared or reappeared from class at will, reinforcing the sense that they belonged not to Alta's world, but to a different one, a world my father couldn't see into. Under Alta's bright lights, these girls' lashes drew vertical bars over their eyes. More than anything, I wanted to know what inside them needed caging. That summer, I suffered pains in my shin bones. I gnashed my teeth at night and dreamed of foxes nipping and gnawing. In July, I woke up 6 inches taller, wrists and ankles rawly exposed. "Come, girlie," my father would say, blowing on a breakfast hot pocket. "Put some meat on yourself." My jaw was sore from clenching. For once, I turned breakfast away. I fled from the kitchen, the single bedroom, the bathroom with walls so thin I heard every effort of my father's body, the living room where each morning my father became a lump on the pull-out couch. I spent my days in the library periodical room, which smelled of mildew. To inhale was to imagine the green of the smoothies aspirants drank in flavors like wheatgrass and kale. I flipped through books my biology teacher had recommended, but my head was as queerly hollow as my stomach. I found myself at the rack of magazines, their colors candy loud. At home, my father limited my TV time. He wouldn't buy magazine subscriptions. 17 magazine, he joked. You have 4 years. What's your hurry trying to grow up so fast? I waded out past diet tips and relationship advice, past starlets smiling their aspirant smiles, until I was swimming in large sheaf tabloids that featured stories of girls missing and found, girls taken and stolen, girls held ransom, and girls held till whatever wet and vital thing inside them dried out. Was it that particular summer that kept violence close to its heart like a dark clot, or was it me? I didn't ask. The two questions were one. I left for school that fall with my hems high above my ankles. "Aren't you cold, then?" my father said as he tried to give me his jacket. But the cold just pushed me upright, pushed me straighter. It was a new season. The less I ate, the heavier I felt. I dozed through class and dreamed of chewing, woke with blood in my mouth and my tongue wedged between my teeth. My body grew dense with meaning, every shrinking inch significant. A fine fur grew over my arms and stomach, warming me in place of food. The bones of my face pushed out, but they weren't the ones I'd known. They'd seemed of another creature. The girls who asked so kindly, "How are you?" soon asked, "Are you okay?" soon asked, "Don't you want to join us for lunch?" and soon asked nothing at all. I overheard whispers from the bathroom stall. "She's a bit off, yeah? Like them." For the first time, silence gathered around me. And then a girl approached. I felt her before I saw her. I'd read about pheromones, those scentless, invisible particles that drew like animal to like through the deepest thickets. "Can I bum a cig?" she said. I told her I didn't smoke. "Oh, I figured you did." Her pause felt approving. "It's good, you know, for the weight and all." I learned that day that even these girls weren't born with nothing behind their eyes. They had ways of inviting it in. In our home, our 400 square feet of garden-level space, where the light through the landlord's elms was forever crepuscular, my father and I shared one bathroom. Its sink had one broken drawer and one working drawer. Again and again, my father forgot any new rules for privacy. Again and again, he exposed my tampons and razors to the light. As I raged, he laughed. "Ah, what do I care, girlie?" My father still cleaned my room and folded my laundry, still dusted the shoebox that held my diary. "I've seen you inside and out. Remember who cleaned your diapers, girlie?" My father moved to press his forehead to mine, as he'd done since I was small. I jerked away. In a flash of inspiration, I drew my lashes down to hide my eyes from the hurt in his. It was first an accident. I was cutting a head of celery, pushing the knife through cell walls, thinking of empty calories and a particular shimmering nothing I'd seen slide behind the eyes of a girl on the late-night news. The knife slipped. My father. 4 long strides from couch to kitchen, and he was there, bending over my bleeding wrist. He blocked my view. His wailing hurt my ears. I pulled free and locked myself in the bathroom. "Let me help," my father said as he pounded the door. "What's come over you, girlie?" His voice swelled and subsided, like the pulse in my wrist, like the warped wood between us. Something like how the pupils of the girl on TV had jumped from small to big as a line of text flashed. Rescued after 8 months, victim. He liked to watch me breathe. a girl in a room, a man in trapping. The suffocation I felt at night as my shins ached from growing, as my father snored through the wall. The bleeding made me feel weaker, then stronger, just as the food I didn't eat made me weaker and stronger. I yelled in a voice not mine, "Stay out, you pervert!" For once, my father had nothing to say. He fled from the thing inside me. The next day, the silence widened, 3 feet, then 5, a moat till I had half the hall to myself and my bloody wrist. I picked at the loose end of the bandage as all Alta watched. I dripped on the floors my father would have to mop. Once again, a girl appeared, summoned by my blood as a shark is summoned across murky waters. It wasn't the one who'd asked for a smoke. This girl took my wrist. Her hand, like mine, was wrapped, but in fabric, not gauze. She wore her shirt several sizes too big, defying the Alta fashion of cuffed sleeves. She was armored in cloth as she turned my wrist. My heart beat beneath her fingers. Her lashes lifted, those cage bars opened. Her teeth showed, shockingly yellow and jagged. And what smiled at me wasn't pretty or sweet, wasn't girl so much as beast. And then the biology teacher called my name and rushed me into a room. The biology teacher leaned forward in a listening pose reminiscent of my father, elbows on knees, spine convex, a cave at her center I was meant to fill with words. "I've noticed some changes in your performance this year. Is everything okay here, at home?" I conjured the nothing over my eyes. "My dear, if you won't talk, I'm going to have to call your father in." My father by day was even more slovenly than by night. If called, he'd lurch through the halls in rumpled undershirt and sagging pajamas. He had no shame. 2 years ago, when he had to fetch me home for running a temperature, he hailed the lunch ladies, clapped the groundskeeper's shoulder so hard girls heard it across the lawn, addressed the dean by a nickname. My father's voice was a brassy trumpet, loud, off-pitch, a dissonance he was deaf to. He asked after the girls' famous fathers. He made jokes and collected tolerant smiles. He winked as I, in my fever, burned with embarrassment. For weeks after, Alta was particularly kind, the questions about my father more charitable than ever. If he came today, Alta would look at me and see only him. He'd undo everything. "No," I said, standing, "not him. Please, anything but that." The teacher flicked her tongue against her wet teeth. She nodded. I must have imagined the click then, as if I'd just given the right answer in Olympiad. "Very well," she said, writing on her pad, "but starting today, Alta will be monitoring you. You're excused from all extracurriculars. Go here at 2 o'clock. Just show this note to your teacher." I entered the territory of the girls. A strange room down a half flight of stairs I'd never seen. Subterranean light, the ceiling dusty and low. One barred window, a cage. It was run by a woman who resembled a mouse, whose trembling voice bid the others to welcome me. "Into our fold," the mouse said, as if they were 4 sheep instead of something else. The 4 ignored her, half a mouthful of a woman, not worth the effort. It was me they watched. Seen up close, their differences became clear. A dark one with shivering pupils, a freckled one with sunken cheeks and fat ankles, an elfin one with unwashed hair and skin, emitting a faint mushroomy smell. And the one who'd taken my wrist, who armored herself with a too big uniform, who wasn't beautiful, but sat as if she were. And me. We formed a circle. The elf spoke first. Her voice was faint. Her arms were furred like mine, more peach than pelt. Her wrists bowed like uncooked spaghetti. She was the thinnest. She was the one who'd asked for a cigarette. "Yesterday would have been," she said. The mouse prompted. "What?" "Her birthday." "Do you mean your sister's?" "Her 20th, or 21st, I think." "How did that make you feel?" said the mouse. "Not much," the elf said. God, how I envied her. She made sister a nothing in her mouth as we girls clotted around her. The mouse moved on. The tall one had a mother at whom she hurled adjectives like sharp rocks. The freckled one spoke of food, how it went down and how it came up, with evangelical thunder, pausing to circle her tongue around her lips. The armored one alone held the mouse's gaze. The clot shifted toward her as she spoke. She twirled her hair, slick and dark, her pale fingers darting indecently through. She was the leader. She described her older lover's tattoos and needles, his hands. "I get visiting rights after the trial," she said. to us, but especially to the mouse, who grew stiller and stiller, as certain prey did on the nature documentaries my father preferred to the news. What did my father know? He scrubbed Alta's hulls, while news about rescued dogs, civic buildings, small-time robberies, and politics washed out as the witching hour washed in. Late at night, the coverage gave way to the faces of girls and what was done to their bodies. Staticky clips from dispatcher calls, teary interviews, but loudest of all, the silence. Newscasters resorted to euphemisms, even as a screen showed photo after bloody photo. When I fell asleep at 3 or 4, it was those unspoken acts I dreamed of, more terrifying than gun or rope. The armored girl knew that same secret. She controlled her body, kept it skinny like ours, but curved in the right places. Sex came off her, which was better than beauty, stronger than the stink of the elf's unwashed hair or the freckled one's vomity breath. She was the kind of girl who scared reporters, scared my father, and scared the mouse, who cut her off and turned to me. "This is a safe space," the mouse said. "You can speak without fear of repercussion. Save facts that might compromise your immediate safety. Do you understand?" I tuned her out. I'd fooled her already. These girls were my true test. "My father," I said to the four of them. "He watches me breathe at night." My father said, "Aren't you a busy one these days?" My father said, "What keeps you so long after school?" My father said, with hope a whine in his voice, "Have you made new friends, girlie?" I erected silence around me. Later that night, as I pretended to sleep, I heard the door to my room open. My father rummaged in my shoebox. Inside, he'd find the diary I no longer wrote in, the mascara I now wore, a list of negative calorie foods, a stack of glossy magazines for my new friends. And he'd find the X-Acto knife. The armored one had handed it to me, showing as she did the parallel scars beneath her overlong shirt sleeves, scars as neat as my celery sticks. I heard my father stand, his breath quickening. I remembered leaning, sodden, against his chest when he pulled me out of public pools where I'd like to sink to the bottom for the pleasure of having him rescue me, for the feel of his love beating hard, whipped into a panic. I studied the armored one's wrist, the elf's trailing sentences, how the freckled one worried her bottom lip until it bled, and how the tall one shivered with rage. I memorized them as I'd once memorized phylum and genus, the intricacies of the digestive system and sodium-potassium pumps, as I'd once memorized the shapes of all 46 chromosomes, trying to decipher in their angles the language of my inheritance. Nimbly, I answered the mouse's prompts. "I don't feel anything unless I cut myself. Sometimes I can't get out of bed in the morning." For a time it worked. For a time I walked the halls with the four and sat with them at lunch. We never ate. We only listed what we'd eaten. All my life I'd been good at beginnings. The promising student, the scholarship case with potential, the desired daughter eagerly anticipated in the baby book my mother filled before she died in birth. But as the weeks passed, there grew between me and the four of them a distance. A pause after I spoke, a narrowing of eyes, a cigarette they passed stopping just before it got to me. He comes into my room at night. He said he's seen me inside and out. The colder they grew, the louder I became to convince them. My voice was cheap and tinny, like the imitation charm bracelet I had begged my father to buy me in my first month at Alta. I lost it after the cheap clasp rusted clean through. I thought I'd found my place at Alta in this cage where girls traded in a currency other than money, but I was still poor. Not in charms and yachts and horses this time. I was poor in neglect, in that cold, instructive pain. I hadn't had tongues or pills or communion wafers forced into my mouth. Instead, I'd had dinners of chicken and mashed potatoes, dutifully stirred halfway through, heating so that they neither burnt nor froze my tongue. I'd had pillows under my cheek as I slept in my father's truck, waiting for him to finish his shift. I'd had, every hour, the shadow of his return to check on me. I abandoned my schoolwork to study the news. Breaking news, late-night news, old news from library records. I memorized captions and quotes. The mouse commended me for my honesty, called it progress. But I knew I was regressing. I spoke from the edge of my seat, spit flying, my spine curving toward my audience of four, back to my invertebrate state. One day I leaned in so far while reciting a headline from 1973 that I fell from my chair. The four watched me sprawl as a mouse ran over, squeaking. She palpated my twisted wrist and rushed from the room to get a nurse. Only then did they descend on me. The armored one grabbed my arm and pushed back my sleeve. Her tongue emerged, neither pink nor red, but moss white like some ancient artifact. She licked my wrist and the ink of my false scar smeared. "You lie." The other three stood behind her. Someone switched off the lights so that the only illumination came from the half window. The girls were vague shapes with flat, bright eyes. "No," I said. I said the ink was practice. I said I was drawing schematics for the real cuts. I said I'd lost the real blade. I said I'd broken the real blade. I said everything I could think of in the face of that silence. I even said, my voice soggy with desperation, that I was too poor to buy a replacement blade, that I'd do it, I would, if they would buy me another. "Please," I said, offering my poverty for them to laugh at, and even this wasn't enough to feed those four sets of eyes, such as you find staring from the brush in wildlife photography. The elf recoiled. She was the first to leave. When I was a small thing, before my father shifted my cot to storage and himself to the fold-up couch, before he taught me to close the door to the single bedroom at night, my father didn't call me girly. He called me inch, as in, "You don't need more than an inch of space, do you?" As in, "Scooch over, inch," when we watched cartoons together. As in, "Eat up, inch." When he carried me, my father had a way of crooking his arm stiff against his chest so that I could perch safely, my torso pressing against his. Till the age of 8, I saw the world this way. "There now, Inch, what's it like to be grown?" At night, my father tucked me to sleep, singing my only lullaby, the Nesquik jingle. Probably he did watch me breathe. That night, I knew I would watch my father breathe, long and deep as he inhaled. "What's cooking, girlie?" Quick snorts as he dug into the shepherd's pie. "Now that's more like it," he said as he watched me eat a forkful of potato. Slower as he lowered his own fork onto his plate. Slower still as he grunted, eyelids drooping. "Delicious," he said, half a pea falling from his mouth. A rumbling, snagging, stalling snore as he fell dead asleep from the pills I'd layered between potatoes and beef. I prodded him. He didn't wake up. I'd given him an extra dose to be safe because he was a fat man. I ran to the bathroom and stuck two fingers down my throat. Up came the potatoes, out came the tears. I imagined starches and lipids untwining from my intestines. On the couch, my father was a pale lump of dough. Those same compounds ran through his blood, the glucose, the cholesterol, the hormones from the farm beef he so loved. His blood like mine, but not, as his loudness and his fat deposits were like mine, but not. I had the discipline to shape myself differently. That night I slept beside my father. In the morning I left him still asleep on my bed, his breath so slowed by pills that for the first time I couldn't hear it. My father had snored for years, a cacophony that startled me awake. I thought of shaking him, but he seemed so peaceful. Today he'd see the daughter he wanted ripped apart by the one I'd become. Let him dream of when I was small enough to hold. At 2 o'clock, after the other four had spoken, I raised my phone and showed the pictures. My father lay on my bed, chest exposed and shirt bunched under his armpits. A streak of stomach hair trailed out of the frame, inviting the mind to complete its path. I lay beside him, staring into the camera, my eyes holding as much nothing as I could summon. Our skins were bluish white. The only color came from the bruises around my neck, circles the size of my father's fat fingers. The four leaned close. I didn't speak. Me, janitor's daughter, I didn't need to. I hadn't been able to show my father beside me without also showing my room, my faded floral sheets, my taped-up photos of lynxes and penguins torn from the used National Geographics my father brought home after I told him I wanted to be a zoologist. To distract from those details, I stood and peeled the scarf from my purpled neck. The girls clotted around me close enough that I could have reached out and clutched my triumph. The mouse began to squeak, but she was only a mouse. I ignored her. I watched the girls. The nothing in their eyes slipped away. Behind it, was that awe? The armored one leaned over to rub my bruise. This time it didn't come away under her fingers. My wounds were tender, and I snarled. She flinched. She inclined her head, the signal of the pack leader's submission to a new alpha. I snarled again when the mouse touched me, but the small woman didn't flinch. Strange. She didn't fear me either. The look in her eyes was what I thought I'd outgrown. Pity. You poor thing. You poor, poor baby. I'm so sorry. I should have intervened sooner. They'll proceed quickly now. I looked at her in scorn. The four did the same, but for once the mouse didn't quail. Who will? I asked. The authorities, the mouse said, stroking my arm so tenderly the hairs lifted one by one. We'll call the police this moment, you poor child. Rest assured, Alta will rally around you. We'll set up a fund. You'll never have to go back. I could only repeat, child? The armored one began to clap the polite Alta clap, fingers against palm. The other girls took it up. Out, the mouse said, and ushered the girls from the room. Out! Leave her alone! The lot of you are behaving like little beasts. Dusk came into the room, stretching the bars on the window till they threw stripes across the floor. I'd never stayed so late. Alta after hours was my father's domain. I turned the knob and found it locked from outside. Somewhere the mouse was squeaking into a phone. I pulled and kicked, but the door was heavy, expensively made. My arms ached from last night's work. I dragged my father from couch to bed for the picture. Sleep made him even sloppier. His arms floppy bolsters, his head at a loll. Friction dragged up his shirt and displayed his love handles. When I heaved him onto the bed, I rested a moment with my head on his chest. What did we look like then? Would anyone have squinted over that photo? I lifted my father's hand, which smelled of lemon-scented cleaner, and put it around my neck. I squeezed, my vision blurred. I rested, began again. Again. It was easier than any X-Acto knife. Nothing to fear, only the hands I'd known all my life. I gave up on the door. I slid to the floor to await my punishment. Sunset painted my cage yellow and then a deep, lasting orange, and I remembered the day I'd grown from inch to girly. The dusk had been this color. I was 8, waiting for my father to return bearing Wendy's, as he did on those rare weekends he'd left to perform extra jobs at the houses of Alta girls. Shadows skittered around the apartment. As Inch, I was fearful. The room shrank, the dark crept closer, and as I hid my face in my arms, I felt the dark reach inside me. With each minute, something within unfurled its limbs, put its arms through my arms, flexed my fingers to claws. I dug ridges in the meat of my thighs, and when that wasn't enough, I turned to my father's prized race car book, its glossy photos of sleek European machines so different from his truck I could almost believe he had taste. My father had promised to return to watch a documentary on big cats. Alone that night, I watched animals prowl the savanna as I tore race cars into strips, scattering a pattern onto the floor. When my father arrived with 2 bags of Wendy's, a Frosty sitting in my spot on his arm, he saw the paper lion I'd constructed roaring up at him. My father didn't punish me. He pushed aside the empty book, pressed his forehead into mine. "Girly," he said, as if unaware of the danger curled inside me. "You've grown a mind of your own, haven't you?" That night he left the single bedroom. He left me the Frosty. He forgave me and never again entered without knocking. How had I forgotten? It wasn't triumph I'd felt when the door to the bedroom clicked closed 5 years ago. It was despair. I would buy him a Frosty when I got out, I decided. I would buy 2. I could almost taste the sweet, cold ache. When the door began to open, I slopped into the breach, pleading, my mouth wide with explanations, never mind how I looked or what I spattered. But it wasn't my father on the other side. It was the mouse, and the biology teacher, and the dean, and a man I recognized as a cop only by the hat he held. "My dear girl," the mouse said as she shook, as if something stalked behind her down the unclean hall. "Your father." In the dusk, the beast twitched its claw against my heart. And that story was Little Beast by C. Pam Zhang from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jessamine Ward. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, Playing Metal Gear Solid V, The Phantom Pain, by Jamil Jan Kochai. First, you have to gather the cash to pre-order the game at the local GameStop, where your cousin works, and even though he hooks it up with the employee discount, the game is still a bit out of your price range because you've been using your Taco Bell paychecks to help your pops, who's been out of work since you were 10, and who makes you feel unbearably guilty about spending money on useless hobbies while kids in Kabul are destroying their bodies to build compounds for white businessmen and warlords. But shit, it's Kojima, it's Metal Gear, so after scrimping and saving, like literal dimes you're picking up off the street, you've got the cash, which you give to your cousin who purchases the game on your behalf, and then on the day it's released, you just have to find a way to get to the store. But because your oldest brother has taken the Civic to Sac State, you're hauling your 260-pound ass on a bicycle you haven't touched since middle school, and thank Allah, if he's up there, that the bike is still rideable, because you're sure there'll be a line if you don't get to GameStop early. So huffing and puffing, you're regretting all the Taco Bell you've eaten over the past 2 years. But you ride with such fervor that you end up being only third in line, and it's your cousin himself who hands you the game in a brown paper bag, as if it were something illegal or illicit, which it isn't, of course. It's Metal Gear. It's Kojima. It's the final game in a series so fundamentally a part of your childhood that often, when you hear the Irish Gaelic chorus from The Best Is Yet to Come, you cannot help weeping softly into your keyboard. For some reason, riding back home is easier. You leave the bike behind the trash cans at the side of the house and hop the wooden fence into the backyard. And if the door to the garage is open, you slip in. And if it's not, which it isn't, you've got to take a chance on the screen door in the backyard. But lo and behold, your father is ankle deep in the dirt, hunched over, yanking at weeds with his bare hands the way he used to as a farmer in Logar, before war and famine forced him to flee to the western coast of the American Empire, where he labored for many years until it broke his body for good. And even though his doctor has forbidden him to work in the yard, owing to the torn nerves in his neck and spine, which you know from your mother were first damaged when he was tortured by Russians shortly after the murder of his younger brother Watuk during the Soviet War, he is out here clawing at the earth and its spoils as if he were digging for treasure or his own grave. Spotting you only 4 feet away from the sliding glass door, he gestures for you to come over, and though you are tired and sweaty, with your feet aching and the most important game of the decade hidden inside your underwear, you approach him. He signals for you to crouch down beside him, then he runs his dirty fingers through his hair and flakes of his scalp fall onto his shoulders and his beard. This isn't good. When your father runs his hands through his hair, it's because he has forgotten his terrible flaking dandruff, which he forgets only during times of severe emotional or physical distress, which means that he's about to tell you a story that is either upsetting or horrifying or both, which isn't fair because you are a son and not a therapist. Your father is a dark, sturdy man, and so unlike you that as a child you were sure that one day Hagrid would come to your door and inform you of your status as a mudblood, and then your true life, the life without the weight of your father's history, pain, guilt, hopelessness, helplessness, judgment, and shame, would begin. Your father asks you where you were. The library. You have to study? You tell him you do, which isn't technically a lie. All right, he says in English, because he has given up on speaking to you in Pashto. But after you finish, come back down. I have something I need to talk to you about. Hurry. When you get to your room, you lock the door and turn up MF Doom on your portable speaker to ward off mothers, fathers, grandmothers, sisters, and brothers who want to harp at you about prayer, the Quran, Pashto, Farsi, a new job, new classes, exercise, basketball, jogging, talking, guests, chores, homework help, bathroom help, family time, because usually mad villainy does the trick. Open the brown paper bag and toss the cush your cousin has stashed with your game because he needs a new smoking buddy since his best friend gave up the ganja for God again, and he sees you as a prime target, probably because he thinks you've got nothing better to do with your time, or you're not as religious as your brothers, or you're desperate to escape the unrelenting nature of a corporeal existence, and goddamn, the physical map of Afghanistan that comes with the game is fucking beautiful. Not that you're a patriot or a nationalist or one of those Afghans who walk around in a pakol and kameez and play the tabla and claim that their favorite singer is Ahmad Zahir, but the fact that 1980s Afghanistan is the final setting of the most legendary and artistically significant gaming franchise in the history of time made you all the more excited to get your hands on it, especially since you've been shooting at Afghans in your games, Call of Duty and Battlefield and Splinter Cell, for so long that you've become oddly immune to the self-loathing you felt when you were first massacring wave after wave of militant fighters who looked just like your father. Now finally start the game. After you escape from the hospital where Big Boss was recovering from the explosion he barely survived in the prequel to The Phantom Pain, you and Revolver Ocelot travel to the brutal scenes of northern Kabul province, its rocky cliffs, its dirt roads, and its sunlight bleeding off into the dark mountains, just the way you remember from all those years ago, when you visited Kabul as a child. And although your initial mission is to locate and extract Kazuhira Miller, The Phantom Pain is the first Metal Gear Solid game to be set in a radically open-world environment, and you decide to postpone the rescue of Kazuhira Miller until after you get some Soviet blood on your hands, a feat you accomplish promptly by locating and massacring an entire base of Russian combatants. Your father, you know, didn't kill a single Russian during his years as a Mujahideen in Logar. But there is something in the act of slaughtering these Soviet NPCs that makes you feel connected to him and his history of warfare. Thinking of your father in a small village, you head south to explore the outer limits of the open world in The Phantom Pain, crossing trails and deserts and mountain passes, occasionally stopping at a checkpoint or a military barracks to slaughter more Russians, and you find yourself incredibly skirting the city of Kabul, still dominated by the Soviets, and continuing on to Logar, to Muhammad Aga. And when you get to Wagjan, the roadside market village that abuts the Kabul-Logar highway, just the way you remember it, you hitch your horse and begin to sneak along the clay compounds and the shops, climbing walls and crawling atop roofs. And whenever a local Afghan spots you, you knock him out with a tranquilizer until you make it to the bridge that leads to the inner corridors of your parents' home village, Nakale, which looks so much like the photos in your own blurred memories from the trip when you were a kid that you begin to become uneasy, not yet afraid, but as if consumed by an overwhelming sense of deja vu. Sneaking along the dirt roads, past the golden fields and the apple orchards and the mazes of clay compounds, you come upon the house where your father used to reside, and it is there, on the road in front of your father's home, that you spot Watak, your father's 16-year-old brother, whom you recognize only because his picture, unsmiling, head-shaved, handsome, and 16 forever, hangs on the wall of the room in your home where your parents pray. But here he is in your game, and you press pause and you set down the controller, and now you are afraid. Sweat is running down your legs in rivulets, in streams. Your heart is thumping, and you are wondering if sniffing the kush, as you did earlier, has got you high. You look out the window, and you see your brother walking toward the house in the dark, and you realize that you've been playing for too long. You're blinking a lot, too much. You notice that your room is a mess and that it smells like ass, and that you become so accustomed to its smell and its mess that from the space inside your head, behind your eyes, the space in which your first-person POV is rooted, you ignore the knock. It's just your little sister. Get back to the game. There is a beaded, heavy-set man beside Watak, who you soon realize is your father. You pause the game again and put down the controller. Doom spits. His life is like a folklore legend. Why you so stiff you need to smoke more, brethren, instead of trying to riff with the broke war veteran? It seems to you a sign. You extract the kush from the trash, and because you have no matches or lighter, you put hunks of it in your mouth and you chew and nearly vomit twice. Return to the game. Hiding in your grandfather's mulberry tree, you listen to your father and his brother discuss what they will eat for Sahur, thereby indicating that it is still Ramadan, that this is just days before Watak's murder. Then it hits you. Here is what you're going to do. Before your father's tortured and his brother murdered, you're going to tranquilize them both, and you're going to carry them to your horse and cross Logar's terrain until you reach a safe spot where you can call a helicopter and fly them back to your offshore platform, Mother Base. But just as you load your tranquilizers, your brother bangs on your door and demands that you come out, and after ignoring him for a bit, which only makes him madder and louder, you shout that you are sick, but the voice that comes out of your mouth is not your own. It is the voice of a faraway man imitating your voice, and your brother can tell. He leaves, and you return to the game. From the cover of the mulberry tree, you aim your tranquilizer gun, but you forget that you've got the laser scope activated, and Watok sees the red light flashing on your father's forehead, and they're off, running and firing back at your tree with rifles they had hidden underneath their patus, and you are struck twice, so you need a few moments to recover your health, and by the time you do, they're gone. Your brother is back, and this time he's brought along your oldest brother, who somehow is able to shout louder and bang harder than your second oldest brother, and they're both asking what you're doing and why you won't come out and why you won't grow up and why you insist on worrying your mother and your father, who you know gets those terrible migraines triggered by stress, and now your oldest brother is banging so hard you're afraid the door will come off its hinges. So you lug your dresser in front of it as a barricade, and then you go back to your spot in front of the TV, and you sit on the floor and press play. At night, under cover of darkness, you sneak toward your father's compound, and you scale the 15-foot-high walls of clay and crawl along the rooftops until you get to the highest point in the compound, where your father stands, on the lookout for incoming jets and firebombs, and you shoot him twice in the back with tranquilizers, and as he's falling, you catch him in your arms. Your father, who at this time is around the same age that you are now, and in the dark, on the roof of the compound that he will lose to this war, you hold him, his body still strong and well, his heart unbroken, and you set him down gently on the clay so that the sky does not swallow him. Climbing down into the courtyard, you go from chamber to chamber, spotting uncles and aunts and cousins you've never met in real life, and you find Watok near the cow shed, sleeping just behind the doorway of a room filled with women, as if to protect them. And after you aim your tranquilizer gun and send Watok into a deeper sleep, your grandmother, a lifelong insomniac, rises from her toshak and strikes you in the shoulder with a machete, and calls for the men in the house, of whom there are many, to awaken and slaughter the Russian who has come to kill us all in our sleep. The damage from the machete is significant. Nonetheless, you still have the strength to tranquilize your grandmother, pick up Watok, and climb back onto the roof while all your uncles and cousins and even your grandfather are awakened and armed, and begin to fire at your legs as you hustle along, bleeding and weary, to the spot where your father rests. With your uncle on one shoulder and your father on the other, you leap off the roof into the shadows of an apple orchard. The men are pouring out onto the roads and the fields, calling upon neighbors and allies, and because the orchard is soon surrounded on all sides, it seems certain that you will be captured. But you are saved by, of all things, a squadron of Spetsnaz, who begin to fire on the villagers. And in the confusion of the shootout, as the entire village is lit up by 100 gunfights, each fight a microcosm of larger battles and wars and global conflicts strung together by the invisible wires of beloved men who will die peacefully in their sleep, you make your way out of the orchard, passing trails and streams and rivers and mulberry trees, until you reach your horse and ride out of Wadjan toward an extraction point in the nearby Black Mountains. But now at the door is your father. Zoya, he is saying very gently, the way he used to say it when you were a kid, when you were in Logar, when you got the flu, when the pills and the IV and the home remedies weren't working, when there was nothing to do but wait for the aching to ebb. And your father was there, maybe in the orchard, maybe on the veranda, and he was holding you in his lap, running his fingers through your hair and saying your name, the way he's saying it now, as if it were almost a question. Zoya, he says, and when you do not reply, nothing else. Keep going. Russians chase you on the ground and in the air. They fire and you are struck once, twice, three or four times. And there are so many Russians, but your horse is quick and nimble and manages the terrain better than their trucks can. And you make it to the extraction point in a hollow of the Black Mountains with enough time to summon the helicopter and to set up a perimeter of mines. and you hide your father and his brother at the mouth of a cave, behind a large boulder, the shape of a believer in prostration, where you lie prone with a sniper rifle and begin to pick off Russian paratroopers in the distance, and you fire at the engines of the trucks and ignore the tanks, which will reach you last, and it is mere moments before your helicopter will arrive, and just as you think you're going to make it, your horse is slaughtered in a flurry of gunfire, and your pilot is struck by a single bullet from a lone rifleman, and the helicopter falls to the earth and bursts into flames, killing many Russians and giving you just enough time to rush into the cave, into the heart of the Black Mountains. With your father on one shoulder and your uncle on the other, and with the lights of the Soviet gunfire dying away at the outer edges of your vision, you trudge deeper into the darkness of the cave, and though you cannot be sure that your father and his brother are still alive, that they haven't been shot in the chaos, that they are not now corpses, you feel compelled to keep moving into a darkness so complete that your reflection becomes visible on the screen of the television in front of you, and it is as if the figures in the image were journeying inside you, delving into your flesh, to be saved. And that story was Playing Metal Gear Solid V, The Phantom Pain, by Jamil Jan Kochai, from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jessamyn Ward. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. Speed of Light by Pat Rushen. Things go wrong. Take Konstantin Muzikovsky. He had everything going for him. Good law practice. Nice secluded house on the outskirts. Sweet little vegetable garden out and back that brought him no end of pleasure come springtime. Handsome, devoted wife. Kids grown and gone. The way Muzikovsky saw things, it was time to ease off and enjoy a tranquil, orderly life. Then zap! One night while they lay in bed watching Johnny Carson, Muzikovsky's wife told him it was over. Johnny's last guest, a religious nut plugging a book, ranted on. "Did you hear me?" Muzikovsky's wife said. "Yes," Muzikovsky said. He stared at the glowing TV. "What?" he said. "A blind man could see it," Johnny's guest assured him. "The signs, the portents, all heralding the impending arrival of the blazing glory of our Lord and Savior. You bet." Johnny nodded sagely. Then, when his guest wasn't looking, dropped his jaw, mugged dopey credulity. The audience roared. "I said I wanted a divorce." Her voice sounded tinny, crackly, vaguely unreal. Muzikovsky turned. She sat stiffly beside him, small breasts wrapped in folded arms, elbows pointing hard angles at the screen. Her narrow chin jerked, thin lips tightened. "What?" he said. She shook her head. "You never listen. I'm telling you, I want a divorce." Muzikovsky opened his mouth, closed it. "When?" he said finally, because he didn't know what else to say. She turned her head, silver curls flashing in the television's glow. Fluorescent tears sizzled down her cheeks. "As soon as possible." Muzikovsky blinked. "Why?" "I can't take it anymore. You're driving me crazy." Her voice was high and tight. "I don't love you." Muzikovsky felt suddenly lightheaded. He stared at the glaring screen before him, tried to make sense of the dizzying rush of brilliant images. The screen flickered, the scene changed again. Muzikovsky couldn't keep up. "Don't you understand?" the voice beside him asked. "You're tired," he heard himself say. "Get some sleep. We'll talk tomorrow." But the next morning, Muzikovsky was awakened by the news on his clock radio, and all thoughts of last night's episode paled in comparison. It was incredible. He dressed and went to the kitchen. His wife poured his coffee, set the newspaper before him. Headlines confirmed what the radio claimed. The speed of light had increased. Muzikovsky took a quick sip, scalded his tongue, scanned the details. It had been disclosed late last night. Scientists all over the world were coming up with the same results. The speed of light, until now constant at 299,792.458 kilometers per second, was speeding up. 3,561.5 kilometers per second last night, over 304,000 kilometers per second at press time. The president, awakened early this morning, had called out the National Guard to prevent rioting and looting. The Pope had requested an hour of worldwide prayer. Muzikovsky sat stunned. His wife stared out the window. He could see the worry in her face, but mostly she was taking the news calmly. That was her style. Muzikovsky folded the paper neatly. "What do we do now?" he said. "Do we take it in stride, or panic, or what?" His wife served him a slice of dry, burnt toast. She folded her arms, stood staring at him. Hers would be a fatalistic view, he realized. He hadn't lived with this woman for 30 years without learning her reactions. Her answer would not surprise him. "There's nothing to do," she said. "It's over." Muzikovsky called his office and told his secretary he wouldn't be in. "You have a meeting this morning," she said. "Cancel it." "But it's with the Central Illuminating and Electric Representative. You have a hearing next week on their proposed rate increases." Muzikovsky laughed bitterly. "It's over, can't you see? It doesn't matter anymore." He turned on the TV in the living room. Special reports filled the airwaves. At last confirmed reckoning, the speed of light had reached 311,218.725 kilometers per second. Carl Sagan stood before a blackboard inscribed with the equation E equals MC squared. He smiled reassuringly, spoke at some length. Muzikovsky couldn't make out what he was saying. The voice crackled and buzzed, then carefully chalked a slash through the equal sign. So much for relativity. So much for a logical, ordered universe. Muzikovsky ran fingers through thinning hair. He could hear his wife puttering about upstairs. Closet doors opened and closed. Hangers rattled and chimed. Muzikovsky shook his head. The most invariable constant known to humankind had become subject to change. Laws of physics were becoming obsolete at every turn. All of established existence was bound to fall apart about them, and his wife was house-cleaning. He had to smile. She always maintained a marvelous sense of balance, duty, attention to detail, an attribute he'd always loved her for. And she was right. Nothing to do now but go on doing what you've always done. Muzikovsky considered weeding and watering his garden, but as he rose from his chair, the latest reading appeared on the screen, 359,028.025 kilometers per second. He looked out the window, squinted at the bright hazy sky, sat back down. It seemed like a bad day to be out in the sun. Morning passed quickly, the television a kaleidoscope of conflicting queries, theories, explanations. Evangelists preached apocalypse, physicians prescribed caution. Scientists scratched their heads, shrugged, chattered helplessly of leptons and quarks and other mysterious entities of various flavors and colors. Perhaps, one physicist said, this was a natural electromagnetic phenomenon that occurred at regular intervals, somewhat like the Earth's ice ages. Maybe, another argued, they'd been measuring wrong all along. Who could tell? Laymen and scientists alike were stumped. Anybody's opinion was worth as much as anybody else's. Sitting, watching, waiting to see just how fast light could go, Konstantin Muzikovsky was formulating his own hypothesis. Things change, that's all. Things you count on. Things you take for granted. Things you never imagined could change. They change. And Muzikovsky thought there was nothing he could do to change this random changing. Nothing but change his attitude toward change. Muzikovsky's wife stood before him, blocking the screen. Sunlight streaked from the window behind her, gave her a burnished silver nimbus. "What are you doing?" she said. Muzikovsky shaded his eyes, smiled. "Nothing. Trying to take this as calmly as you, I guess." "How are you doing?" He shook his head. "It's not easy. You expect things to go on, like always. Then all of a sudden something you've always taken as given." He stopped. She was biting her lip on the verge of tears. "I'm sorry," Muzikovsky said. "Since there's nothing we can do about it, I guess there's no sense dwelling on it." She switched off the TV. Muzikovsky caught an update before the screen winked out. 374,243.999 kilometers per second and climbing. Still climbing, getting faster and faster. Where would it stop? Would it stop at all? What would happen if it didn't? Would the universe simply fibrillate itself out of existence? Who could tell? "I'm sorry it had to happen," his wife said. "I know it came as a shock." "Shock," Muzikovsky echoed. "Yes. But you couldn't lose your frame of reference no matter what. One final measure of control." He was sitting in his own home. His garden was growing out back. His wife was at hand, talking to him, soothing him. "I'm not just doing this on a whim," she was saying. "I want you to know that. I've thought about it for years, but there were the kids to think about. And then there was habit, too, I suppose. I always hoped things might get better." "What?" Muzikovsky said. She was sitting on the arm of the chair, touching his hand. Her fingers felt hot. "Maybe I'm not being fair," she said. "I just can't go on, that's all." Muzikovsky stared at the blank screen. It seemed to brighten. Slowly at first, then faster and faster. "Do you understand?" she said, gripping his arm. He pulled his gaze from the television, looked up at her, astonished by her sudden urgency, but the glare from behind her slashed at his eyes, blurred his vision. "My bags are packed. I've called a cab. We can work out the details later." She was crying now. "Just tell me you understand why I'm doing this." Things were far too bright. Everything was going faster and faster. Muzikovsky couldn't think, couldn't look at her anymore. He lowered his eyes, blinked. "Doing what?" he said. Her grip tightened on his arm. He heard sobbing, his heart quickened. He patted her hand. "Would it help to talk?" he said. And that story was Speed of Light by Pat Russian from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.